So tonight I would like to talk a little bit about training, what I'm going to call our body-mind. And interesting how we can train our mind. It's actually trainable, I've discovered. So the mind is mental phenomena. It's thoughts, feelings, perceptions. And one way to work with the mind is to work with the body. I've learned from Aikido training, a very strong strain of my background, that my body reacts before my mind knows what's going on. And when my body reacts, it releases chemicals. And when I'm in a stress state, cortisol is released. And what that does is it actually shuts down the part of my brain that governs big picture thinking, creativity, innovation, and risk taking. It narrows my perception. It also makes me feel separate, individuated. And so, in Aikido or in sports or in any art, you actually train your body to have alternatives to fight, flight, and freeze. Because basically that's what the body has. The limbic system, the body, is very simplistic. The neocortex, the mind, is very refined and complex, and it gets it. If understanding was enough, we'd probably all be enlightened. Because we understand, we've read the books or written them or whatever. But how do we change and train the body to have alternatives to fight, flight, and freeze in low-grade threat when we're stressed? And by low-grade threat, I mean voicemails, emails, your own mind, self-critic, somebody looks at us, traffic. All that is a type of low-grade threat to our body, little things going on. So, my mind is the starting point, though. And what the mind needs is motivation. So, I have to want to live with compassion, with kindness, with grace. That's the sort of starting point. And one of the ways to support that is through a sangha. It's through daily practice, it's sangha, it's, in this case, taking the time to actually think about and find things that are inspiring that I care about. I always feel more energetic, more empowered, and more fierce when I'm working on behalf of than when I'm doing it for myself. And being part of a sangha, we recognize that we're in this together. That we come not just for ourselves, but on behalf of the community. And we appreciate the teachers and each other and ourselves for coming and being part of it. So, I'm a horse person. I grew up riding. And when you learn to ride, first thing you have to do is make a connection to the horse. And that's like, how do I connect to my mind, in a way? How do I get to know it, be kind to it, and at the same time learn how to manage it so that it doesn't run away with me? Get into the future where I get all concerned about things or ruminate in the past or I'm critical about things. How do I keep coming back to the here and now? And just like a horse, which is a large, strong animal, it's not a good idea to bully our mind. So for me, it's really an issue of balance. When we ride on a horse, we need to have balance. And when we're learning to manage our mind, we need balance. The thing about balance is that it's actually the ability to maintain equilibrium, which is a state of constant flux. It's not a static state, equilibrium. We're constantly adjusting around a reference point when we're in equilibrium. When we walk, we're constantly adjusting. So one way to think about working with the mind is to be sure that our body is in a good place. So just the difference when we did our little exercise of when my body, I tightened it and I thought about a chore I had to do, my mind had a certain attitude or mood. And when I opened my body and I thought about the chore, my mind perceived it slightly differently. Which leads me to believe that when I change my body, I affect my mind. So it's actually very simple, but not easy. Because we're used to certain body patterning. We've done this hundreds of thousands of times. I just closed and I slumped a little. I could pretend it's relaxing, but it's not. It's collapsing. And so when I uplift and I open, it starts to change the chemicals that are being released. And to make us feel connected instead of isolated, we want to release oxytocin. And the quickest way I know how to do that is to spend a few seconds thinking of something or someone that makes me smile. And as you do that and you feel that little bit of warmth, that's oxytocin. And because of mirror neurons, when I'm feeling more uplifted and I have a feeling of warmth in my body, it's sort of catching. Other people notice it. And if I feel kind of heavy and a little annoyed, then that affects, if you're looking at me, the way you feel in your body, because I'm the so-called teacher. So when we're working with our body to be more uplifted and more open and more warm, we could think we're doing it on behalf of others. That way we don't have to feel that we're just struggling with ourselves. Because if I have that and I put it out into the world, others catch it and they feel better. And then we're really practicing spreading Buddha nature. The reason it's hard, though, is because of habit. We have habits of body and habits of thinking as well. Our mind is not that creative. We think the same thing kind of over and over again. And many of you have meditated for a long time, I know. I've meditated, been in the process of it for 48 years, and made some progress, which is a good thing. For me and everyone else too. But it's very humbling to realize how powerful the habits of my mind are, even after all these years, they kick in. The good news is I have a way to work with them the same way when I was younger and I used to train horses, is when the horse would start to react, I would find a way to calm it down and to refocus it. And I want to put in a plug for change your body first, then work on your mind. Because it makes such a difference. And it's not easy, but if you do it a few thousand times, it becomes easier. But the good news is one of those little exercises can take 5 seconds. Just uplift. Think of something that makes you smile. Boom. That was it. And then the next thing I know, I'm like, oh, I can't believe they did that. And that tightening starts. And then I can catch myself and I can uplift. Think of something that makes me smile. The other piece that's helpful and then not easy is to keep opening. Keep opening. Keep opening. It's very difficult because when we're threatened, we close. The body closes. We individuate, we separate, and then we have strategies to try to manage people, things, and concepts. And as some of you know, in the leadership embodiment model that I've developed, we say that the strategies are control, approval, safety. And I'm big on control, micromanaging everything. It's my strategy to try to create security. Then there's approval. I want you to like me, but not too much. A little bit more. Oh, that's good. Constantly trying to get the right amount of approval so that we feel secure. There's nothing wrong with this. The problem is it just takes a lot of energy. And when we're doing that, we're not actually working on behalf of. We're trying to protect ourselves. So, I think that we could practice and find little quick, fun, short ways to do it. Just throughout the day, a little more uplift. And we kind of push it for a second or two, and then after that we could just think about the centrifugal force that's going on with the earth spinning, that there's a natural upliftedness, and we could just hook on to it. And when we want to settle and soften, we could hook onto gravity. So these are natural energies that are going on all the time. It's simply a question of relating with them, noticing them, and noticing this when we start to collapse a little bit, and encouraging this. So, the other thing is that thing about being open is that when we open and we push our personal space out, it's the message of inclusion. We're in this together. Often we're in our own program. We're here and then we say nice things or think nice thoughts or do nice things, but you're there and I'm here, and people become other. With the exception of our significant others and loved ones, they're always in our personal space. We can be halfway across the world, call, and they're right there connected to us. But we go to a grocery store and the person who serves us is other. So the practice would be, how can we start to include and have that feeling of openness with people who are not our significant others? It's kind of a radical idea, but maybe we could start to walk around that way. We could go into grocery stores, and if we're standing with our cart, we could just open our personal space, our bubble, and the person in front of us and in back of us is in our space with us. They're not separate. There's little ways we can practice. And when you think of, if you've had the great fortune to be around some of the really amazing spiritual teachers, you probably felt a little bit of this, that sense of what they call a big presence, a warm presence, that quality of Buddha nature. They feel big because they're included. There's a sense of whoever is in that room with them is actually in their personal space. And we can practice it. Just from time to time, however big your personal space is, what they say, the neuroscience people, is that generally our brain maps everything inside of our reach as us. So my brain thinks that this is me. And of course, when I have significant others or family or children, my brain considers them part of me. But when I go out in the world, people are other. They're not me. So the invitation would be, how do I take that bubble, which when we walk around, according to them, is some version of our arm's reach, and how do we try to push it out and make it bigger? And then the inevitable question comes, what about people who are toxic in my personal space? And my response is always, the one with the most juice wins. So if somebody is a 50% toxic energy, I need 55, 60% of warmth, compassion, shininess, brightness. Then they don't get to dominate. So those people who are annoying and difficult are actually our greatest allies, because they can make us practice harder, be more energetic, and I'm not going to let them win. If that person is negative or toxic or annoying, I'm going to beef up my warmth, my compassion. Those Buddhist principles of inclusion. And we can't always do it, but we can certainly put certain areas into practice. For instance, you could choose, okay, I'm going to, for a week, do grocery stores. That's going to be my place of practice. And there's always somebody annoying in a grocery store. So you get to practice with them. Or you could just choose a little area, and that's going to be your, like, practice area. When we do Aikido, we go to the dojo, and there's a mat, and we train together and we practice. We actually attack each other so we can practice being open and relaxed, finding positive resolution. So your grocery store could be your little training area. Something like that. Just see if you can push the edge a little bit, help to grow ourselves, train our mind. There's a wonderful line from the Dhammapada that says, as irrigators lead water where they want, as archers make their arrows straight, as carpenters carve wood, the wise shape their minds. I find that very inspiring, because it means I don't have to completely succumb to my judgmentalness, my neediness, my incessant planning. I can actually intervene with myself. And I do think that in order to intervene with my mind, if I intervene with my body first, it's easier to adjust my mind. So let's just do a little exercise again, and then I'll take some questions. What I'd like you to do is close. Maybe slump a little bit, cross if you'd like, or tighten. And once again, think of something you have to do in the next day or so that's not your favorite thing. It's just unpleasant. And spend a few seconds just thinking about that. All right, let's stop that, because I'm sure we had a story right away. Now, as we inhale, let's just see if we can lighten up a little bit. And as we exhale, let's think of something that makes us smile, or somebody. And then, if you can, just let your arms get a little straighter, and for a moment, imagine lights in your fingers. You're just trying to run a little bit of testosterone there, which is the opening thing. See if you can find a point on the far wall and push your personal space out a little bit. And now think of that same event again, the chore you have to do. Is it different? Is it less annoying or less stressful? For me, it is. I mean, I still have to do it, and I'm not excited about it. Nonetheless, it feels more like, okay, that's something I'm just going to do. I didn't feel as much constriction. My mind didn't start to build a case around why me. So that's a little example of how, if we shift our body, it starts to shift our mind. Then we might go to the next place and recognize that if I am more open and I am more warm, I'm actually doing something good for people. I'm putting good energy out into the environment. And someone might catch it. Just like if someone smiles at you, you're likely to smile back. So just that feeling of putting good energy out. And then there's going to be stuff that's going to happen. We find ourselves right back to old thoughts, old body behaviors. And there's nothing wrong with that. We need to be gentle. I actually, in my meditation, a couple of years ago, had this insight. I do this practice of when thoughts arise, rather than waiting for them to dissolve. Many of you know that the rhetoric is everything arises, abides, and dissolves. Well, I can tell you after 20 years, that stuff wasn't dissolving. So being an American, I got proactive. And coming from a teaching I had from a lama where he said you can dedicate your thoughts to emptiness. I had this idea of taking my thoughts and putting them out into the space. And at that time, I thought I was freeing myself from my thoughts. And then I had this insight that I thought was really cute, I still do, that I'm actually freeing my thoughts from me. So if I'm having a judgmental thought and I'm like, oh, I'm judging again, I go, there you go, you get to be free. Which makes me smile a little bit. So it's a way of working with my mind that's not so heavy-handed. That's a little lighter. So any way that we can start to find that balance, balance is really important. When am I indulging my thoughts? When am I getting caught in the story? And when am I pushing them away? Just thinking, no, go back to breath, thinking, no, go back to breath. In a way, that's sort of pushing them away. But if I can, for a moment, be kind to my thought, oh, there you are, thought, hi. And now you get to be free. And it might pop right back again, that's just fine. I could greet it kindly again. Oh, hello, you're judging again. Ha, look at that. And judgment, you get to be free. I even have some students who say they have little buckets that they put the thoughts in, or little bowls, one for judging, one for planning, one for anxious thoughts, which I thought was really cute. I don't do that, but I thought it was a very cute idea. So some way to be a little bit more kind of light and fun with ourselves. Have a little fun instead of being so heavy. We need to work with ourselves. That goes without saying. Otherwise, we're just stuck in samsara and we just keep doing the same thing over and over again. But at the same time, if we can lighten up, because I remember training horses was always trying to find a way to make it enjoyable for the horse. So the horse would like the activities instead of feeling like I had to control the horse and the horse felt controlled. So how can we be partners? So that's a little bit what I'm doing with my mind, is kind of wondering how can we be partners and work together. At the same time, I need to be disciplined and manage myself so that my mind doesn't go nuts. And when my mind is going nuts, one of the first things I try to do is change my muscle groups. Because flexor muscles and tightening only adds to the mental stress. extensor muscles opening. And I'm thinking of something that makes me smile. And I mentioned this before in some of my talks, but I find very valuable this very simple version of Tonglen. Tonglen is Tibetan Buddhist practice of you breathing in the negative and breathe out the positive, which people go, ah, but it's actually wonderfully healing. And what I do is I try to catch thoughts that are starting to organize around concern or irritation before they get to be fear and anger. And then what I do is I'll breathe in the concern and I breathe out gratitude or appreciation. And generally speaking, we recommend that the exhale is twice as long as the inhale in general, because the inhale triggers the sympathetic nervous system, fight or flight, and the exhale triggers the parasympathetic nervous system, the calm down part. So if I were to take three sharp inhales, my body goes into a state of alarm. I could put a story on it, but it's actually just the physiology of the inhale. If I take a long exhale, and I always like to think of it down so I can settle, my voice drops and my parasympathetic nervous system kicks in. My body feels more nurtured, more cared for. So if you wanted to explore this little Tonglen exercise, if you become aware that you're feeling irritated, you could breathe in the irritation and then just breathe out either appreciation or gratitude. And if it's spinning a little bit, you could do it again. A little irritation for three and a little gratitude for six. And I notice after about three rounds of that, it totally shifts it for me temporarily. And those temporary shifts are really wonderful because they give me a time out from my normal struggles with myself. Or sometimes I think it's them that I'm struggling with, but generally what Pogo said, we found the enemy and it is us. Or the founder of Aikido said that the attacker is not out there, it's in here. And when you come into harmony inside yourself, you can handle anything out there. But coming into harmony with ourselves is not easy. Although, as I started the talk by saying, the body-mind is trainable. And the important piece to be sure we don't avoid is training the body, because it's the one that will override the mind. Our mind, we could tell ourselves, don't worry, it's not a big deal, don't worry, and the body's going crazy. And we still worry. Because you've got certain chemicals going through your limbic system, and the limbic system is much more simplistic. It just thinks danger. So if you can train your body in those moments of what I'm going to call low-grade threat or stress, to uplift and open, and think of something that makes you smile, then you've got a whole different system that isn't going to undermine how you work with the neocortex or your thinking process. I think I'm going to stop here and see if there are any questions or comments.
Question about maybe you mentioned control. What was this?
Approval,
and then safety. Can you say something more about safety?
Safety is sort of at the when we're operating from this deep core level, it doesn't have to make sense. It's not about whether others like us. It's just about this has to happen. It's sort of like a mother who's taking a child's toddler's hand across the street, and the toddler's like, I don't want. And the mother's like, I don't care if you want to hold my hand. Boom. You're coming from a safety place. You're not trying to get the child's approval, and it's not even micromanaging. It's something deeper than that. Does that make sense? So we have this part of us that I call safety that will just kick in, and it's not about making sense or having a good connection. It's a deeper survival part of us.
I really appreciate everything that you're saying about the body, you know, about everything, and particularly about how important it is working with the body first. One thing I want to ask you, and maybe this is a, kind of another, in some ways, I may know the answer to this, but I want to hear what you. So I am. Do you think if having a practice such as yoga, being in a practice such as yoga, kind of moves you into being, kind of sets you up, or I don't know what's the right word, prepares you for onslaughts during the day?
Well, my main concern about almost every physical practice is that generally it's left on the yoga mat. I mean, I have friends who've done yoga for years, and I remember I was somewhere, we were in Bhutan, and I was saying I had done a downward dog and these beads fell out of my pocket. She goes, "You did a downward dog, like just by yourself in the morning?" She was a yoga practitioner of 20 years. She'd never done yoga at home. And I was like, astounded. She was astounded as well. We were both astounded at each other. But can you go into the world, into the grocery store, and bring the qualities of yoga to your shopping? Then it's absolutely a support system. But as we know, many of our great athletes leave it on the field, they leave it on the court, and they act inappropriately when they step off the court. So the idea is, how do we translate that into our everyday lives? How do you use a kind of a posture and a sort of openness that you might get in a yoga pose and bring that feeling out in as you walk to your car, as you go into the stores, before you sit down in front of your computer? Little breaks during the computer. Then absolutely.
I do notice that the days that I do start, and that I am better prepared,
You'll be better prepared, but it's a percentage game. So how much percentage time do you do yoga versus the rest of your life? So, you know, if you're 10 or 20% of your time is yoga, but if you can pick that up by during the day, inserting ritual during the day, you have actual, people who have carpal tunnel syndrome, they have their computer set to these alarms that make them stop and do some exercises so they don't stay in their computer for so many hours. We have an app. It's 99 cents. But the idea is that you can set an alarm, and what it does is it goes off, it goes zzz, leadership and time to center, and you could just do 5 seconds. So I would, my personal view is better to do 5 seconds 20 times a day than do a half an hour in the morning and then forget it. Because I did that for years. I've been meditating a long time. And in the early 70s, I did 10-day silent retreats, and that's when it was wild, too, back then. before it all got organized. And then I would sit sometimes an hour every morning, but 15 minutes later I'd be in the kitchen, my kids would be yelling, and I'd be a basket case, even though I'd had amazing experiences on my zafu. So it is my so far belief that it's great if you have a morning practice or a dedicated practice of meditation, yoga, I would highly recommend. And I think it's really important to have it throughout the day, 10 or 20 times. If you do 5 seconds 10 times a day, it is less than a minute. Mm-hmm. And why not? We certainly waste 5 seconds all the time. So take 5 seconds and uplift. Open up. Think of something that makes you smile. Boom. And unless you're totally stressed, you've changed it. If you are totally stressed, it will probably take you about 30 seconds to reboot. You have to spend a little longer thinking of something that makes you smile, be a little more, you know, work the extensor muscles a little more. So that would be my hope, is that we can start to pepper it throughout the day, because then the neural pathway keeps lighting up, and the system starts to think, oh, kind of that's the way I am. Otherwise, the neural pathway only lights up in the morning for a half an hour. And then the system thinks, that's my morning, then the rest of it I just do my neurotic thing. I use that term loosely for you psychologists. Any other questions or comments or thoughts?
So I've been practicing about the last month or so with this
rebooting while I'm in the car.
So I thought, okay, I'm going to start off before I start in the car. I'm going to sit. That totally forgot that. I needed some inspiration. So what I find is the first time I start to react when I'm driving, I have a little Buddha and I just grab him and I say, I'm going to be kind. People are going to be kind to me, and none of this is personal. And it is just making it so much easier to
that's
drive.
Wonderful. I love it. Well, some of you know my story, is that I'm Irish and I'm very reactive. React like that. And drivers almost always irritate me. I irritate myself too, but people are really irritating.
They are.
Yeah. And I put myself in that. But I have what I call my posse. Some of you know this. And it's sort of like having an entourage. And I choose a particular quality of posse when I need a particular energy. So Mother Teresa is my go-to when I'm in the car, because my first response is, what an idiot. And then I think, oh, Mother Teresa, and immediately when I think about her, it changes my energy, and I think, be careful. And then a minute later, someone else, and I think, you're an idiot. And then I think, Mother Teresa. But the good news is that I keep touching into that compassion. And so, you know, that's another thing you can do. You have the Buddha. I put Mother in my car. I need her in my car. And then I have His Holiness the Dalai Lama on my desk, and then also the founder of Aikido. And over there I have some inspiration cards. You guys are welcome to take one. We call it your posse starter kit. We put Wonder Woman in this time for courage. And the idea is to think about people or things, there's some nature ones too, that are inspiring as a way to connect to a positive feeling. So it's a way to actually, like you grab the Buddha, and it's sort of like bringing Buddha nature through you. So I think for me it's a real shortcut. Instead of trying to find it inside me, instead of telling myself, don't be so upset, be nice, be kind, I'd end up struggling with myself. But he is an idiot. If I think that I'm drawing from that inspiration outside of me, it's a little more immediate, and then I don't fight myself. So it's just an idea. Some way to keep connecting to our higher Buddha nature, our bigger selves. And it really is us out here too. My neuroscience friend, when I say that we don't end at our skin, she goes, you have no idea how right you are from what science has. And we know, because we feel each other, we touch each other at a distance, that we don't end here. So we might as well use what's in the space. Because there's plenty of challenging energies out there in space these days. And they're all over, because they're all over the media. So we need to be a little more proactive of connecting and getting pictures of Buddhas or whatever it is, so that we can connect to the positive side and have that work on us instead of just the headlines. But thank you for saying that, because any way we can do it, we should.
Idiots are village idiots. Our village includes.
What?
Yes. Absolutely. Nicely said. Well, we're all neurotic, and we're we all have cultural neurosis and personal neurosis, but we also all have Buddha nature. We're both. And even our sort of neurotic self is our humanity. It's you've heard me say this before, but being an avid gardener, I think of it as our compost. Right? And compost is shit, and you put it on the soil when it's treated properly and beautiful things grow out of it. So by making friends with our neurotic mind, our judging, our neediness, our anxiety, and treating it properly with kindness, setting it free, or whatever strategy that you would use, we begin to accept that part and we can relax with it. And then when it shows up with someone else, we don't have to be as reactive toward them because we realize, I have it too. And I'm happy I don't have to be as extreme as maybe that person is being right now, but I know what it's like to be judgmental or mean-spirited or anxious to the point where it's ridiculous. I've been there, and I've watched my mind through the sitting. So if I can relax with that a little bit, and when I'm reacting, I tell myself sometimes I'm having a compost moment. It's okay. It's just, again, a way to be lighter with myself. So it'll pass. Yeah. I don't want to live in a compost pile. But it's okay to have compost moments, because everyone does. There's a wonderful book out these days called The Book of Joy. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend it. It's the Dalai Lama and Reverend Desmond Tutu's conversations about joy. And something that's so endearing is the way they tease each other and talk about their own problematic nature. And if anyone could pretend to be holier than thou, it would be them. You know, those are some pretty holy people. And they don't. They're very human, and they talk about themselves that way. And so it's so great to see we all have it. And we could just relax a little bit with it. And it's really important to activate our sort of highest self by remembering that we really want to cheer ourselves up on behalf of others. Because when we're more cheered up and we're more warm, it helps other people. So we might do it a little more often if we're doing it for people we care about. Because when we're in a bad mood, it affects the people we care about. And if we can build up our capacity to cheer up, then sometimes we can tip the scales, that if they're in a bad mood, our cheerfulness might be able to be like a positive virus. Any other questions? Comments? Well, I thank you very much for, as always, being open and willing to my perspective. You've heard me say this before, but I find it's like sitting. It's something I have to work with continuously. And it's good to have the reminders. In any way we can help each other and keep waking up during the day. Remember what the Buddha said when he got his enlightenment and people came to him and said, "What are you? Are you a devil? Are you an angel? Are you a god?" And he said, "I'm awake." So if we can keep waking up to our Buddha nature for just moments, seconds throughout the day, it could start to change the baseline. And if that baseline starts shifting, then we can feel the whole Sangha elevating itself.